Podo. You're listening to The Election Tricycle with Tom Hamilton, Emily Tamkin and Rohan Venkat.
Welcome to The Election Tricycle, a show on elections taking place in India, the UK and the US and around the world. I'm joined by Tom Hamilton in the UK.
Hello.
And Emily Tamkin in the US.
Hello.
We start off this week with a bit of breaking news taking place in the UK before we jump into our main subject for this week. Tom, you want to tell us what's happening a little bit there?
Yeah, the big breaking political news in the UK as we record, and it's not all over as we record, is mostly to do with parliamentary procedure, the neutrality of the Speaker of the House of Commons, various bits of parliamentary precedent, and all sorts of complicated things like that. But it's also about the ongoing war in Gaza and the nuance of exactly what each party wants to say and wants not to say about it, and about all parties and all MPs wanting to be able to say that they have voted in favour of very specific positions. So the situation is that opposition parties in the UK get to have what we call opposition day debates every so often, in which they can choose the subject of debate. They put forward a motion, it gets voted on. It's not a legislative motion, it doesn't change the law, but it says what the view of the House is. And nearly always an opposition party will choose an issue that's probably embarrassing for the government or potentially just important in the world, say what they think about it, vote on it, and as a matter of course, get defeated by the government. They will try and embarrass the government, but it doesn't have a huge amount of impact in the real world. Now, this week, the opposition party that is entitled to bring forward an opposition day debate is the Scottish National Party, who are a smaller party in the UK, not the main opposition, but the dominant party in Scotland, who have a much more straightforward immediate ceasefire position, as far as the war in Gaza is concerned, than either of the two main parties do, and have brought forward a motion that says that. Now, what that means is that they have a motion that the government will oppose with an alternative amendment, which is a bit more nuanced on the exact terms on which a ceasefire should take place. And Labour would want to amend the motion too, but with slightly different wording. But because it's the SNP's motion, under normal circumstances, the House would vote on that and then would vote on the government's position, and that would be it, which means that Labour would not get to express their view. Now, why that matters is that Labour MPs want to be able to say that they are now in favour of a ceasefire in Gaza, because that is Labour's position. But they're not in favour of a ceasefire in Gaza on the SNP's terms, which is why they can't vote for it. And they are not in favour of it in quite the same way that the government is putting it, and they don't want to just vote with the government. But under normal parliamentary procedure, they wouldn't get to vote on it at all. Are you still with me at this point?
We're following. We're hanging in there.
So what the Speaker, who is an MP who is neutral in the debate, who is in this case, a man called Lindsay Hoyle, who was originally voted for as a Labour MP, but is now, as the Speaker, neutral and above politics, he has to make a ruling. And he's made a ruling today that he will accept the Labour amendment, which is not what would normally happen, and therefore that the House will vote. First of all, the House will vote on, as I understand it, the Labour amendment, and then it will vote on the government amendment. And the final upshot of that will be, although it hasn't happened yet, that the government will win. That's never been in question. But MPs of the two main parties will have an opportunity to vote for their party's position and will be able to tell their constituents critically that they have voted for a ceasefire, which matters enormously to Labour MPs. But as I say, for various political reasons, Labour wasn't going to let them vote with the SNP motion. That has meant that because the Speaker is breaking with precedent, that Tory MPs are now saying that we should get rid of the Speaker. SNP MPs are potentially working with them for that to happen. We do not yet know where that will lead. Last time I looked at Twitter, which is before I started this recording, he was still the Speaker. I think it's more likely than not that he still will be. It's also emerged that as part of the negotiations with Labour to try and get him to make this unprecedented ruling, Labour threatened him that if he didn't accept their amendment, then they would see to it that he was removed as Speaker after the election if Labour wins. So all sides are allegedly saying that the Speaker's position depends on him following their view on this particular amendment. So it all gets into a whole realm of sort of parliamentary procedure. But what it comes out of, and the motivation behind the Speaker's ruling, if we can take out the possibility that as a former Labour MP, that might have been what was influencing him, which to be fair, I'm not sure that is the case, is that he is very concerned that MPs of all parties are coming under quite considerable pressure from constituents, including receiving threats in some cases, because of the position that they're taking. And that in Labour's case, a position which is pro-ceasefire but anti-voting for any ceasefire proposition that's before them could make it look as if they have a position that they don't have and make them more vulnerable to certain kinds of attack. And I can understand why he would be concerned about that. But nevertheless, it involves moving from a position that they'd had. So I guess what it highlights is that this is really contentious within British political discourse in a way that involves a huge amount of nuance that is not normally able to be covered by parliamentary procedure. And therefore, that's where the debate has gone today in terms of parliamentary procedure. What it amounts to, actually, the upshot of it is whether MPs of whatever party will be able to be targeted by certain kinds of Facebook ads and similar, saying that they did or did not vote for a particular position, which actually matters in both electoral terms and in terms of how MPs perceive their own safety. We have had, not over this issue, I must stress, but we have had MPs murdered in this country within the last few years from more than one party. We have had MPs getting death threats, so they are concerned about this. So we don't know where this is going to go. We don't know whether the Speaker is going to carry on being the Speaker. We don't know. The other political subtext of this is that the SNP and the Tories colluding over anything plays quite badly for the SNP in Scotland. So all these things are sort of in the mix. But as things stand, I think the debate is going on, and we will have a vote in which Labour MPs will get to express their party's position, and so will the Tories.
Yeah, I think, and I do want to flag for listeners that next week on this podcast, we're going to spend the entirety of the time talking about Israel's war on Hamas in Gaza, conditions in Gaza, anti-Semitism and Islamophobia in politics in our countries. But what I wanted to say just quickly this week is that I think the fact that this is unprecedented and that it's happening over this issue speaks to the salience of this issue in domestic politics in a way that we don't always see with foreign policy, right? Like it's more the fact that everybody wants and understands that they need to say something in a very particular way because it matters so deeply to their constituents, I do think signifies that this is not, like, it doesn't play the way a traditional foreign policy issue plays. It's unprecedented over this issue for a reason.
Yeah, I agree with that. And it is because of the fact that both anti-Semitism and the existence of Israel and the right of self-defense and the manifest sufferings of the Palestinian people all come together at once. And reasonable people can both think that all of these things are awful and that particular aspects of them should be emphasized in different ways, mean that for political parties that are trying to appeal broadly, it's an enormous minefield to try and walk through. And I think it's in UK politics, it's more of a minefield for the Labour Party because of their recent history and because of elements of their electoral base, by which I mean both some of the ethnic makeup of their electoral base and some of the broader sort of the different elements of left-wing views that they are trying to appeal to. And of course, their recent history of having been led by Jeremy Corbyn all make it quite difficult because they're trying to distance themselves from certain things while not distancing themselves from other things. The Tories find it a little bit easier for various reasons, which isn't to say it is easy for them because it's still an intractable, very hard foreign policy issue. But Labour find it especially hard, I think it's fair to say.
Yeah, we'll have a lot more on that next week. But we're going to turn now to a different foreign policy issue that plays not at all in the same way, really, I think, in any of our countries, which is Russia and Russia's war in Ukraine and Ukrainian sovereignty. Obviously, the sort of direct impetus for this conversation is the death of Alexei Navalny. We could say the murder of Alexei Navalny, because regardless of whether he was killed in the manner that his team and his wife are alleging, he was killed by the Russian system. This was not, he's not even 50 years old. This was not a death that had to happen. And I think, you know, I think in the American context, it's interesting because on the one hand, I think on the one hand, this sort of goes to the core of what Biden ran for in 2020, at least in foreign policy terms, right? Like Trump was so laudatory of Russian President Vladimir Putin. I think Europeans are rightly wary and skeptical and afraid of what will happen to NATO should Trump return to office. I think the idea of his, you know, his total disregard, even rhetorically, for human rights, like all of, you know, Biden sort of came in on the promise to, which I think was fulfilled in some ways and not at all fulfilled in other ways, but to restore America's role is with regards to liberal democracy around the world and human rights and all of this. It's so core, right? Oh, and we should say that while traditionally supporting Ukraine and speaking out against Navalny's death, like that would have been an easy consensus issue for Republicans. Today in the Republican Party, this is not the case. I think for culture war issues, for culture war reasons, there's that have nothing to do with actual lived reality in Russia. There is a lot of fondness for Putin in some parts of the Republican Party. There's a complete, in Congress still, they're tied up over whether there should be additional funding for ammunition for Ukraine in its war, or in Russia's war in Ukraine, I should say. However, I don't know that we're seeing this matter to the electorate in a way that it speaks to the issue of how to say this. It's so central to the difference between these two parties and their approach to foreign policy right now. And yet, I don't know that it matters to voters at all, really. You know, there was polling from Pew this week that said 74% of Americans view the war in Ukraine as important to U.S. national interests, 43% said very important, and 59% of Americans said that the war in Ukraine was important to them personally. I just don't, not to call my fellow citizens liars, but I just don't believe that 59% of Americans are thinking of Ukraine when they go to the voting booth.
But it's come up in terms of the amount of aid, military aid and other aid that the US is providing to Ukraine as a really contentious issue. And the UK Foreign Secretary David Cameron was in Washington last week calling on members of Congress to vote in favour of providing more military aid to Ukraine and getting short shrift from certain Republican Congress people. And I also noticed yesterday Donald Trump comparing himself to Navalny as someone who has, been the target of certain legal proceedings. I mean, there's not a huge resemblance there.
No, it's also like it's just a deeply offensive thing to say. It's
absolutely.
It's also just deluded. Like it's you're not leading an opposition for a free and fair Russia. You are on trial for trying to steal an election. Like it's just not anyway. So yes, and it comes up. You know, obviously Trump's ties to Russia. Obviously, Trump's alleged ties to Russia were a big talking point for Democrats in Trump's term. There was the summit with Putin in Helsinki, in which Trump said, well, I'm not sure why we wouldn't believe the Russians about whether or not they interfered in our election. There's just like his history of speaking with a true fondness for Putin. And I think it's funny. In the past, like the fact that the foreign minister from the conservative party came to the United States and it was the Republican party that he had difficulty with, I think is quite telling and sort of speaks to where the Republican party is right now on this issue. The fact that you have senators saying like, why are we supporting war? Why are we, they present it as like, we're just helping Ukrainian boys continue to die and we should be helping our own children, you know, and protect them from these migrants. Like, first of all, why are you connecting American immigration policy to the war in Ukraine? Second of all, what is the logic here? It's just the sort of like isolationist bent. There's a lot of, I think, you know, there's sort of a fondness for conspiratorial thinking in certain segments of the Republican Party. The war in Ukraine fits really nicely into this. We should also say that Trump's first impeachment was around Ukraine, right? Because he was trying to essentially blackmail President Zelensky into opening an investigation
into Hunter Biden so as to harm Joe Biden's presidential campaign. So there's no like great love for Ukraine and its sovereignty and right to defend itself within these quarters of the Republican Party. And I don't like, yeah, I'm sure that's somewhere in the minds of those Republican voters. But again, I don't think that that's the primary, like that's not what's primarily motivating them when they go out to vote for Trump or for Senator J.D. Vance or for whomever.
It was really flabbergasting to see the move from Republicans towards like their sort of Putin philia under Trump. I mean, given Russia as the famous enemy of that side of the U.S. But I'm really curious, are there folks on the left side of the American spectrum who are also, I mean, we know the Democratic Party under Biden is solidly behind, you know, Ukraine. But there's been bits of the Democratic Party in the past that have been pacifist, that have been isolationist also in their own way. I'm curious if there are elements that, you know, I don't hear much about that side, whether there's any of that in American politics at the moment.
Yeah, I think the far left in the United States is more critical of the idea of funding a war. Like, I think it's not quite as the elected members of Congress are not quite as like wash your hands of this as the elected far right. But yeah, there still is a pacifist streak on the far left of the American political spectrum and anti-interventionist in different ways. And I think this you don't see in Congress, but there is still this sort of fringe, like, you know, who are we to lecture Russia? And if Mexico wanted to join the Warsaw Pact, like, you know, we would be so upset. And this is all the fault of NATO for expanding, you know, as far east as it did. And on, which, if I can opine, I think is actually in a way still an imperialist position, and that it doesn't take into account the stated desires of the countries sort of in that part of the world. And I think dividing the world into spheres of influence is like, that's not an anti-imperialist take. But nevertheless, there is that position on the left in the United States as well. Absolutely.
One of the issues in the Cold War was that for the US to be a major guarantor of Eastern European, well, European security against the Eastern Bloc wasn't just about the security of those countries. It was perceived by American leadership for both the Republican and Democrat parties as being an issue of American national security. But it seems that for a lot of Republicans, that just isn't remotely what's at stake in terms of what's happening with Russia and Ukraine, which seems like a real, I mean, there are lots of departures, but that in itself seems like a real departure, that this is just not our war and not our problem. It's just not the approach that they would have taken to a hypothetical Soviet incursion into West Germany in the 1970s, say.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think on the one hand, there's something sort of honest about admitting, like, if Ukraine loses this war, is that, you know, is the United States going to collapse tomorrow? Like, no, it's not. On the other hand, the United States did not set up the rules of the game out of the goodness of its own heart, right? Like, I think the reason that there are so many so invested in preserving the status quo is that it over the past however many years has been very beneficial to the United States. And so the idea that this has nothing to do with us, I think, is quite is just quite disingenuous, right? The idea that that somehow we're not involved here when it's in part because of policies that the U.S. pursued, I think. And I don't mean NATO expansion, right? I mean like the security structure of the North Atlantic and the U.S. and Europe. I think is sort of a bad faith reading. And I know, you know, Rohan, I know that there were many, not only in India, but also in India, who sort of said like, okay, like, yeah, this does benefit the United States. This does not benefit us. There was a lot of talk earlier on in the war about how Biden's talk about how all liberal democracies or all democracies needed to stand together against Russia rang really hollow in the global South, which was like, what are you talking? Like, you guys are hypocrites. You know, like the United States is not spotless on this issue. I would argue, and you can push back, that, and I think India's position on Israel's war has made this clearer. I'm sure there is some element of that. I also think India has taken the stance it has on Russia's war in Ukraine, like out of self-interest, right? And because they still get the majority of military equipment from Russia and because they were able to buy cheap energy. And I think we kind of like, yes, some of it is about the global South and the hypocrisy of the United States, but some of it is about self-interested geopolitics from the Indian perspective.
Yeah, I think the context for those who are not familiar, India's from the beginning refused to condemn Russia, has not spoken of the war on Russia in so many terms, has not been party to United Nations votes on this, and has not just continued to be close with Russia, but is expanding ties in a sense. It's also continued to buy oil from Russia, for example, and that's a complex thing where it got a lot of pushback initially from Western nations about it. It's not party to the sanctions, for example, but in the role India played in the global energy markets has ended up to some extent helping the West. And so it doesn't now get as much of the criticism from the West that it got in the initial few months when people had expected India to sort of toe the American or the Western line on this. It's undoubtedly out of self-interest, and more so it's very it's not even sold as an idea of values. The utility of this for India is the idea that the West should not be able to lecture us on, you know, the international order, the rules-based order, etc. Every country should be able to operate based on its self-interest. That means that India's actions, whether that's on democratic backsliding or things like that, can also be then immune from questions from the West on issues of values and so on. India would prefer that we don't talk about values, but at least the current India would prefer that we talk of self-interest. This week, the foreign minister gave an interview to a German newspaper where he was asked about India with regard to Putin. I don't know if Navalny came up in this or it was before, but it was in the same context of how India can continue to have such close ties with Russia. And his response was that Europe started buying out a bunch of oil from the Middle Eastern partners, you know, right after the war so that they could cut themselves off from Russia. And then we didn't have access to oil from anywhere. So we had to preserve our self-interest. Europe continues to buy gas from Russia and, you know, nobody makes an issue about that. Russia has stood by India over the 30, 40, 50 years when the West was selling arms to Pakistan. So this is the broad selling point. And it's definitely one of self-interest. The way it translates on the ground in India is that Ukraine and Russia is not a thing that shows up. It's not a partisan issue, certainly. Although there have been some in the Congress party and on the other side who have criticized India for not taking a more moral stand on the issue. There's lots of threads where Modi is both taking, he calls it multi-alignment instead of the non-alignment of the Nehru years, is both taking the approach of like, I'm going to work with all partners and we'll work towards peace. He famously told Putin, this is not an era of war, you know, in a meeting. But at the same time, Nehru made morality a big part of his international politics. At home, it plays at the end of the day, because India ended up becoming a swing state, it plays as another sign of India being courted by global leaders, a sign of Modi's growing stature globally, where everyone wants India on their side. And look, Modi was able to tell Putin, this is not an era of war, even though it didn't necessarily achieve anything. And at the same time, he continues to build ties with the US and so on. So it's not a partisan issue, but it's definitely been converted into a political win for the government in India.
Yeah. You know, I know that for a while there, it seemed like the US had decided instead of trying to appeal to India sort of on a moral level, it was going to try to stress this is about sovereignty, right? And this is about one country not taking a bite out of another country, which, you know, they sort of hoped would appeal to India because of China. However, the Indian response to this, spoke to people in New Delhi about this, and they were sort of like, yeah, okay, we care about our sovereignty, right? Like, we care about our territorial integrity. We're not going to, you know, we already have to manage this relationship with China. And part of how we're managing the relationship with China is by trying to keep Russia from, one hears this a lot, like, oh, the whole reason that the US, that Russia is so close to China is that you guys, the Americans, sanctioned Russia in 2014. And so they had to go to China. They had no choice. And we're trying to keep them from going even further into China's arms. And like, isn't China the big threat? The American response to this is that, well, there were sanctions on Russia in 2014 because they annexed Crimea, but never mind. But I do wonder if the, like, if Russia-Ukraine doesn't play in Indian politics, but does China? For voters, I mean.
Yeah, again, it's not very partisan. China is now pretty standard. This was not necessarily the case a few years ago, but after India and China in 2020 had the first sort of violent clash on the undemarcated border in 40 years, involving the deaths of people, soldiers on both the Indian and the Chinese side, it's a pretty non-partisan issue in a sense. The BJP and the Congress and several other parties argued that the other had cozied up at one point. You know, Modi was famous for actually building good ties with China as a chief minister when he ran the state of Gujarat. But today China is very clearly, I mean, there's some polling on this about Indian voters, and China is clearly the enemy. The US and Russia are often up there as the top two preferred partners of India. And it's interesting to see Russia remain up there. There's old Soviet links because the Soviets did support India in ways that the Americans and the West didn't, many, many years ago. But it remains, there's a strong lobby as well as historical impetus for India-Russia ties. And it is the case that the Joe Biden administration's efforts to turn this into a democracy versus autocracy thing did not work. India's not been in a position to leverage what is now seen as the Western hypocrisy over the Gaza war, because India is also sort of supporting Israel on this, as we'll discuss next week. So the Indian government has not been able to use that hypocritical argument, but it's what's spoken off record a lot, that, you know, that was the biggest war ever and you supported Ukraine. And suddenly when it comes to this, you know, there's a big question of hypocrisy that sort of is the undercurrent of this conversation. And so the whole selling point of particularly democracies versus autocracies did not play.
Yeah. And Tom, it's sort of, my sense is that it's nonpartisan in a different way in the UK, which is to say that, like, both parties support Ukraine's right to defend itself.
Yeah, I think it's fair to say that both parties are in basically the same place on Ukraine. To the extent that there's, for want of a better phrase, an arms race at all, it's in wanting to be absolutely clear that both parties, whoever's in government, will continue to provide support to Ukraine, both rhetorical and in terms of military aid and so on. And it's couched very much in the sort of moral terms that it's couched in by US politicians in particular. I'm actually really intrigued by, you know, I come from a country whose leaders like to talk about foreign policy in moral terms when they can. That's clearly been the case in the United States a lot of the time in terms of how American leaders like to talk about foreign policy, with the big exception of Trump, actually. I wonder if that's a business background, but he was much more prepared to talk about self-interest and deals and so on in a way that feels quite alien to both the politics that I'm used to and the politics I'm used to seeing coming out of America. And that's clearly not the same way that it plays in India. And that's really fascinating. Everyone acts in their own self-interest, but some countries' politicians will say so, and others will prefer to use different language. But no, it's really striking, actually. I mean, the line to take by a lot of people who don't like Boris Johnson very much is that he was wrong about nearly everything, but he was right about Ukraine. He was one of the first. Well, I don't know if he was one of the first. They all probably did it at the same time, but he was very much on the Ukrainian side of that from the start, and he providing aid from before the actual Russian attack took place. And that position just hasn't changed at all through the two changes of prime minister we've had since then. Keir Starmer visited, I think, Estonia a few weeks ago and posed in military clothes and did all the things that leaders of the opposition have to do to show that they are serious about security and defence. I mean, I think there's a couple of things going on there. One is that all opposition leaders sort of have to pass the bar on national security, which can be quite difficult to do because they are generally people without any experience of this. Starmer is helped by the fact that he just looks like a relatively solid middle-aged white man who looks okay in military fatigues compared to some people. In Labour's case, there's also a differentiation position from the previous leader, Jeremy Corbyn, whose attitude towards Russia and the United States actually was very different, and who hasn't taken the same view on Ukraine and would not have taken the same view had he been either leading the position or indeed prime minister when that happened. But I think we're going to see a total continuity of position. One striking thing this week was there's a very right wing Tory backbencher who's got a very straightforward anti-immigration position in general, like called Lee Anderson, who is a sort of an outrider for the right of the Conservative Party in many ways, but was speaking in Parliament the other day, asked a question about making sure that Ukrainian refugees in Britain would have the right to stay here for as long as the war carried on. That is not the position he takes in regards to immigration from other war-torn areas of the world. But it's absolutely the sort of the conventional right and left position in relation to Ukraine, Ukrainian refugees. So not an election issue here, not a political issue here. To the extent that there's any sort of arms race or ratchet at all, it's just to be more supportive to Ukraine. The big question for UK politics and for European politics more generally is, if Trump were to win, what would that do in terms of the collective response that they would have to make? Because I mentioned earlier about or the US Republican Party not necessarily seeing it as a national security issue, whatever else they see it as. It really is a security issue for Europe, the further east you go. And I think there are ways in which European countries, including the UK, which is no longer part of the EU, are going to have to work quite closely together if we get to a point where we have a Republican administration in the US and an ongoing war on Europe's borders or within Europe, depending on where you draw the borders.
Mm. An issue I am sure we will come back to in weeks to come. We have to leave it there now for our regular listeners, premium subscribers. We'll be right back after this goodbye message. Thank you so much for listening. Please like, subscribe. We're still a new podcast. This is our fifth episode. So tell your friends and your enemies to give us a listen. And thank you so much for taking the time. We will speak with you next week.
The Election Tricycle is a Poddo podcast hosted by Tom Hamilton, Emily Tamkin and Rohan Venkat. It is series produced by Nick Hilton. Tweet us at Tricycle2024 and watch a video version of the show at cooler.news. For sales and advertising, please email nick@podopods.com. podopods.com.